Listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
Well, it's a hell of a way to produce radio, but here's the first half hour of the Dustbin of History while I assemble the remainder of the program. I'm your host, Max Mead, no longer the board operator who must be polite and act as though I'm wearing a an evening suit. Oh, Tuesday nights, gotta love them. All right, on with the show. Max will be here in a moment to tell you all about it.
What is it you want, Huffy? I would like to come in and read the Word of God with you. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you? Leave me alone!
Good morning.
Good morning. I think you guys are doing a terrific job. There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Max Schneeb is brilliant, and R. Paul Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. That's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
And welcome in to the Dustbin of History. Watch your step, don't fall in. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmeed, and what a program for you today. Not one, but two never-before-rebroadcast episodes of Gene Shepherd in our second hour. We will begin with a new zero-hour program hosted by Rod Serling, and a rare treat from the WBAI archives, an episode of The Radio from 1971, featuring a story by John Collier, and Chapter 1 of Doctor Strange versus Dormammu, a long-sought-after series. And I hear in June, when the producer comes back to this country, he may send me all of them. At least that was the promise 6 or so months ago. Well, we shall see. In the meantime, we have one for you tonight. But let's begin with the Zero Hour, the fifth storyline in the series from, Monday, October 8th, 1973. The story is called But I Wouldn't Want to Die There. And our cast features Nehemiah Persoff and Brock Peters. So let's hear episode one of But I Wouldn't Want to Die There from the Zero Hour. And I have to say that unlike those nice fine air checks from WRVR, some of these network versions that I found online, not so hot. The sound quality of this is a little problematic. I hope it improves as the series goes on. But we had to put something on, so here it is, the Zero Hour, to kick things off in the dustbin of history here on WBAI New York.
The Hollywood Radio Theater. Every day at this time, Monday through Friday, a J.M. Koller's Enterprises production, The Hollywood Radio Theater, presents an unusual tale of mystery and suspense. Every week, Monday through Friday, The Hollywood Radio Theater presents...
I'm Rod Serling. You're listening to The Zero Hour. Rest your eyes. Exercise your mind. This week, stand in for a labyrinth of tropical intrigue. But I wouldn't want to die there. Starring Nehemiah Persoff. Brock Peters. Marge Redmond. In Elliot Lewis's production of The Zero Hour. Have you ever put together a jigsaw puzzle? Begin with the pieces that have a flat edge. They form your perimeter, the frame. From there, work inward, turning each piece to examine all possible angles. A good puzzle has several pieces cut to nearly identical shapes. This checking and counter-checking is tedious work. But soon things begin to fall into place. You begin to get the picture. Whole sections fill in until you've only the last few pieces remaining. This week's tale is a real puzzler, a story within a story, a winter's tale of summer past. Come to the Caribbean islands, visit exotic St. Martin, say the brochures, where it's summer all year round. Quite a temptation if you're spending January in New York City like Sylvia Bennett. But she's already been to St. Martin, and one visit was enough. She could never go back. Not after what happened. Though even now, those last pieces don't quite fit. But that was over. Much has happened to her since. The decree finalizing her divorce, a new job, a new apartment. And now her mind was made up. For Sylvia Bennett, New York in January was perfect for suicide. For Sylvia Bennett, St. Martin is a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to die there. Our story begins after this word. Picture this. Snow is falling on Manhattan. January thaw is late in coming. A yellow taxi spins around the corner at 103rd and West End and settles to a stop astride a brown snowbank piled high on the curb. Woman steps from the passenger side out into the ice and slush. A handsome man of 42, her expression is one of bitterness. The wind chills off the ground. A gust of wind off the Hudson River swirls the virgin snow into her determined face as she struggles her way indoors.
Oh, New York, I despise you so. I must leave instructions. If found, please ship in a plain pine box to anywhere far away. Regards, Sylvia Bennett, deceased. Damn, you're so slow. The mail. Why not? Let's see what bills my estate will have to pay. Con Ed, Lord and Sailor, telephone company. What on earth? Postage due, 14 cents? Saint-Martin? More travel guides? No more trips for Sylvia. No more bills. No more of this hideous planet. And this time, no slip-ups. Damn it. They'll have to break the door down to get me out. There. Next step. Good, stiff belt of scotch. Harakiri right here on the living room rug? Nope, too messy. A bullet in the brain. No gun. The window. With my luck, I'd land in the snow, break my back, and live. God, it's quiet. I wonder. All these pages. Dear Sylvia, don't throw this away, please. The way I look at it, you owe it to me to read it. I spend a lot of time writing it down, and the least you can do is read it. I deliberately didn't see the papers when it was all over. I suppose I should have, but I just didn't want to see what they said about us. That's the kind of coward I am, but then you know that. Damn it. Can't you people let a wretch die in peace? Hello.
Hi, it's Carl.
I know, I recognized your voice.
How have you been? How's the new job?
Ghastly, thank you, to both questions.
You didn't have to leave Day, you know. Divorced people do work together. It is done.
But Day is your magazine. I'm just a reporter, remember?
I'm worried about you, Sylvia. You won't do anything foolish.
I'm a big girl now, and I'll thank you to mind your own business.
Now, hold it. What the hell's wrong with you, anyway? We were getting along all right. We could at least be civilized, and then... Ever since you got back from that island, the past 6 months, you've been... What happened? Do you need money?
I told you before, I don't want your money.
Sylvia, are you...
No, I'm not crying. It's just this damn cold. Look, nothing happened. I just got sick in the gut, that's all, of everything.
If you need someone to talk to...
No, thank you, doctor. These four walls will suffice. They listen rather well, you know. I've nothing more to say to you, Carl. Goodbye. There. No more interruptions. You've written a novel. Oh, what terrible handwriting. Tad, what the devil have you done? Oh, dear Sylvia. No, that's the kind of coward I am, but then you know that. I had to set things straight.
You'll forgive me if I don't have much faith in newspapers and magazines. But set it straight to whom? People wouldn't believe me anyway. That's when I thought of you. That's one of the times I thought of you. Anyway, I've told it the best I can. I start with that day last summer when all hell broke loose on Saint Martin. I was taking my evening walk along the beach. It was a dark night, though once the sun goes down, all nights are dark to me. I don't see well without my glasses. I should say I hardly see at all. I'm a congenital myopic anyway. Since I've covered that ground so many times, out where the pier juts out, along Molly Smith Point, I knew where I was. What I didn't know was what I would find. A body. A woman's body. Hello? Who? You there? Are you hurt? Oh, my God. Oh!
Help! Somebody! Everybody, come quickly!
What
What's up, Mr. Cobb?
Alphonse, there's a woman here. I just fell over her, I think.
What wants the famous actress, Mr. Cobb?
She looks bad. Her head is all smashed up.
Is it Miss Lee?
Where are you going? These men from the river. Cowboy, they hear you too. Sound like you hurt.
No, no, I'm all right, Wong. Shine your torch over here.
Oh, my God. Well, Mrs. Lee. Yeah, she looks dead, Mr. Cat.
Who's Inspector Leclerc? Is that you? Cal Wallander here.
It's Annabelle Lee, the actress. She's been badly hurt.
We were about to call you. She may be.
She's dead.
Dead.
Ready?
She's up. What is up?
Count the tracks here. See? We are all standing in our own.
I'm afraid I can't see what you say. You see my glass?
There are no other tracks, not even her own.
What about the tide, Inspector? Couldn't it have washed them away?
Monsieur Cadwallader, the tide is coming in.
But then how? What could have happened?
At the moment, monsieur, who's to say? But I believe, I am not certain you understand, but I believe that Madame Lee was battered about the head with some variety of very obstinate material.
Battered? You mean... on purpose?
One cannot say for certain just yet, Monsieur Cadwallader. Mais oui. It appears that Madame Lee was murdered.
It took me a long time to fall asleep that night. I couldn't get that terrible image out of my mind. To quote Poe as best I can, the beautiful Annabelle Lee in her sepulcher there by the sea, in her tomb by the sounding sea, lying there in the surf in her white bathing suit, her head, oh, a terrible sight, awful. I keep a supply of very potent sleeping pills on hand for just such emergencies. I took 3 that night, which was more than I'd used for since... the days when... well, but Sylvia, you must know what day, what years I refer to. I needed the pills then to survive. This time I hoped if I slept deeply, I would awaken to find it was all just a bad dream. Lord knows how long Eloise, our maid, was knocking, trying to rouse me before I stirred.
Monsieur Pat! Monsieur Pat!
Eloise! What's the matter?
The gendarmes, Monsieur Cap. The gendarmes are here.
Oh, yes. Yes, Eloise. Tell them I'll be right down.
The lounge was nearly deserted. Inspector Leclerc was waiting for me. With him was a certain Captain Dubois, who looked very official indeed. They were accompanied by Gerard Bonaventura, a diminutive fellow with big owl eyes and big round glasses. Gerard was the owner and editor of the Island Voice in Saint Martin's only newspaper. Do you know yet was she murdered?
Even now, Dr. Fortier is conducting its post-mortem.
Have you been able to reach her husband?
The guests in the house, Bates, I believe is their name, have sent a cable to Puerto Rico. They are trying to reach Mr. Lee by telephone as well.
There is no Mr. Lee. You see, that was her stage name. His name is Tolliver, Robert Tolliver, very big in New York advertising. A genius, I read somewhere. He sold his business last year and retired.
Excuse me, Mr. Codd. Eloise say you need new handles on 2 windows. You drive me to Marigot for them?
Yes, as soon as these gentlemen are through, Alphonse.
For the moment, we are through. Fini. Your presence will be required should we have an inquest.
I understand. Come, I'll show you out. If I can help in any way, I'll be here, of course. And Gerard, you will spell my name correctly. 2 L's?
Do not worry. I have all that you say right here, Mr. Cad.
I must admit, I admire Alphonse's nerve as a passenger, the way people drive on Saint Martin and the roads between the potholes in the grade and the livestock crossing at will. It's a virtual obstacle course. And I must remind you that my eyesight isn't all that it could be. If Alphonse was frightened, he camouflaged it well.
When is Mr. Max returning? Watch out, Mr. Card. How's crossing up ahead? Mr. Max will be surprised that he missed all the excitement. Careful, Mr. Card.
Max told me at the airport he'd be back by the end of the week. He had to order some new mattresses and...
Look out for that dog, Mr. Card.
I'm sure Max will spend a couple of days living it up. You know how he is.
Yes. Mr. Max likes the ladies, eh? You handle the business while he plays.
I wouldn't say that exactly, Alphonse. Max is just, women prefer a man with a beard to a fat old fogey like me.
Oh, you're not fat, Mr. Card. You just have a lot of skin.
Thank you, Alphonse. You put that rather well.
Mr. Card, Mistress Lee promised me a present, but she never gave it to me. A yellow wig with long curls for the carnival next year.
You ask Mr. Tolliver about it when he gets home. Not right away. Wait until after the funeral. I'm sure he'll give it to you.
But why can't I ask Mr. Robert for the wig right away, Mr. Card?
Well, he'll be very upset about his wife's death. He'll be very, very sad for a while.
Oh, I don't think so, Mr. Card. He used to hit Mistress Lee real good. Make her cry, make her eye black all the time.
What? Did you tell that to the gendarmes?
The gendarmes? Of course not, Mr. Card. They didn't ask me.
Lunch was being served on the terrace when Gerard Bonaventure stopped by looking very excited.
Dubois and Leclerc are questioning all over town, going door to door. They think now it was done in a boat, that she was pushed over the side into the water.
Why in a boat?
Because of the tide and lack of footprints. Dr. Fortier has determined the time of death between noon and early evening.
That's a lot of time. Couldn't he do better than that? It seems to me it had to happen at night. Surely someone would have seen her get into a boat in broad daylight.
It is strange. No one saw her all afternoon. The American couple, Bates, they were in Philippsburg all day shopping, and Maria Lisa, the maid, she was at the dentist for her teeth that are not so good. They all come back to an empty house. But I think somebody must have seen. That was a very good-looking woman. The gendarme will find out nothing from the people.
I think you're right. No one wants to get involved.
I shall go to each house, too. This is the mark of a professional reporter. Yes, the people here are my friends. They will tell Gerard more than they tell the gendarme.
I went to bed early that night. You may not believe this, Sylvia, but I had a dream that a lovely woman would soon enter my life. I took my coffee on the gallery the next morning. Across the street, I could see the gendarme's jeep parked in front of Annabelle Lee's house. I wonder who could be coming to Grand Case in a taxi.
It's a woman, Mr. Card. She's coming here.
Undoubtedly an American.
Pretty woman, too.
Oh, she sure knows how to walk. I'll say that.
Well, I have to go now, Mr. Card. I'll see you later.
Mr. Card, there's a lady here wants a room.
Very well, Eloise. I'll be right down.
Poor cat. I had you charmed before I ever saw you. She knows how to walk. That's a laugh. Oh, if things had only been like they seemed to you. Had I come to get away from it all like I told you. But that wasn't the reason. It wasn't all a lie, though. I did come over from St. Croix. Carl and I were as good as divorced. He was vacationing in Christiansted. I knew the hotel. We'd been there often enough as husband and wife. I kept telling myself I wasn't chasing him. We were all sitting together at poolside. Carl, those three vacant but beautiful young women, and good old Sylvia, when we heard the news.
Sylvia, you knew Annabelle Lee.
I interviewed her a couple of times.
I've got a terrific idea. San Martin's the next island down. Get on a plane and see what you can find out. The innocent tourist bit. Try to find a spot to stay in the village where it happened.
I don't know why I took the assignment. Perhaps to convince Carl that I was better than those stupid women. Those cheerleaders, all bust and no brain. So, I knew how to walk. What next, Cad? I decided to go down
onto the beach. I didn't do that often, not at midday. My new guest was there. You, Sylvia. Wearing a red low-cut swimsuit and white bracelets that sparkled in the sun.
Are you going to sleep, or would you like some company?
I'd welcome company. Mrs. Bennett, is it?
Oh, Sylvia. This is my first visit to San Martin, and I don't know a soul.
Well, I'm Jeffrey Stamp Cadwallader.
Oh, my, that's a mouthful.
People call me Cad. It's an odd name of endearment. I've gotten used to it, though. Those are pretty bracelets you have.
Oh, thank you. They're turquoise. Rather common these days. They used to be chic. Who lives over there?
Annabelle Lee. I should amend that. She lived there once.
The actress? Oh, didn't I hear somewhere that she'd passed away?
As a matter of fact, I found her right over there by the pier. A terrible thing.
You know, you've got the prettiest place on the beach.
Mm.
How did you find it?
My partner, Max Terry, found it. I can't take credit.
Your partner?
Yes, he's a very nice man. You're sure to meet him. He's due back from Puerto Rico any day.
Mm.
How would you like to have lunch with me?
Oh, I'm so sorry. I've already eaten. Oh, I ordered a cab to take me over to Phillipsburg to do some shopping.
Well, then how about cocktails, dinner?
Oh, I'd like that. Say about six?
About six.
Poor Cad. You are even more blind than you imagined. And I was so ruthless. Oh, I went to Phillipsburg that afternoon, all right. But not to shop. I went to the telegraph office and wired St. Croix asking for information. Somehow, I was perplexed. Frightened by a big teddy bear of a man with thick glasses. He reminded me of someone. A face in the newspaper. And the name, Max Terry. Suddenly, while looking at my own reflection in those tinted eyeglasses before leaving the beach, the names and faces crossed a span of 25 years. I was fresh out of journalism school. My first assignment, a murder case. Helen Terry, 14 years old, pushed to her death off the rooftop of her family in Queens. She had a brother, Maxwell, in his middle 20s. And he had a friend, a heavy-set, myopic friend who was found guilty as charged. But the other name, not Cadwallader, but Johns. Joseph Johns. Oh, Cad, I had to do it. Please forgive me.
Tomorrow at this time, rest your eyes and listen here to this week's continuing study in suspense. But I wouldn't want to die there. I'm Rod Serling, and this is The Zoo.
You've been listening to the Hollywood Radio Theater's presentation of The Zero Hour. Heard every weekday at this time. Rod Serling is your host. Danton Forbes, But I Wouldn't Want to Die There, was adapted for radio by Kim Weisskopf. Nehemiah Persoff is Cad. Rock Peters is Leclerc. And Marge Redmond is Sylvia. Featured in the cast are Herbert Rudley, Jester Hairston, Mady Norman, and Victor Bozeman. Zero Hour is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Jack Myers is executive producer. Rochelle Sherman, associate producer. And Kim Weisskopf, story editor. Music conducted by Stanley D. Hoffman. The Hollywood Radio Theater theme was played by Ferranti and Teicher and is now available on United Artists Records and Tapes. This has been a J.M. Colas Enterprises production. Hugh Douglas speaking. Tune in tomorrow and once again,
rest your eyes and listen here
to The Zero Hour.
This is Craig Stevens. I'll be here next week as Lloyd Mercer on Hollywood Radio Theater's brand new Zero Hour. Mercer is a deep-down politician of the old school. We've received some new information on the Henley murder. It points rather definitely toward your culpability. Apparently, there was an eyewitness.
Someone saw me kill Henley?
Please listen to George Maharis, Charles McGraw, and me next week when the Zero Hour presents Dead Man's Tale.
And we'll hear the next two episodes of But I Wouldn't Want to Die There from the Zero Hour by Stanton Forbes. Okay, well, we've been featuring programs that I found in the WBAI library before we moved out of, 505 8th Avenue, perhaps? Yeah, we used to have something called the Drama and Literature Department, and there were tapes on the walls from our archives. And this is one of the only episodes of the radio that survived, and especially the only episode, well, there are a couple more, but the only one I have that I can lay my hands on right now, of Doctor Strange. That's right. The Marvel comic brought to life on the air by the folks from the radio. And it begins with a short story by John Collier called The Frog Prince. So enjoy this episode of the radio from 1971, coming your way in the dustbin of history on WBAI New York.
The scheduled program is, yes, a rebroadcast of the radio. Good evening. What? It's 8 o'clock already? But my nestle rose. Okay. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the radio. I'm John Basis, your host. You kind of caught me in the middle of dinner. Well, that's all right, I won't be long. In the meantime, why don't you just listen in on the two young men sitting at the table over there? I'll be with you right after I have my coffee.
You'd better marry my sister.
That's a strange thing to say, considering I've told you all about my debts.
I'm not worldly. I should prefer my sister to marry a clean, decent, and kindly fellow like yourself than some rich but blasé, roué, cynic, near-man, sub-man, or half-man.
Well, I'm certainly not blasé. Hmm. On the other hand, I never had the pleasure of meeting your family when I was in Boston.
I'm very fond of my sister, in a way.
Oh, how delightful. No doubt she was a mother to you when you were small. A little mother?
No. No, she's 10 years younger than I am. Only 28, in fact.
Sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad she has come into her fortune just in the rockiest year of our financial history.
Fortunately, it's well invested and yields her an income of $40,000.
An objection occurs to me.
Uh-huh.
We are men of the world, Henry. If we were of the other sex, we might also make mistakes. Fond as I am of children.
That would be a matter entirely for you to decide.
Henry, your sister sounds charming. Tell me more about her. She's not by any chance a teeny little woman.
Quite the reverse.
Quite the reverse?
My dear Paul, I don't mean to say that she's 6'4".
6'3", perhaps?
And a half. But perhaps I should tell you she's rather plump. Disproportionately so, in fact.
Good God, I hope she's good-natured.
Angelically. You should hear her petting her dolls.
Pardon me, Henry, but is she at all backward?
Matter of opinion. She reads and writes admirably.
How delightful. We could correspond if I happened to be away.
Yeah. I'll be frank with you, Paul. Her letters to famous boxers are quite amazingly expressive, though by no means perfect in orthography.
Henry, she's capable of hero worship. She has an affectionate nature.
Almost embarrassingly so. It appears from these letters of hers, which we censor, that she would make a devoted wife. However, my family are old-fashioned, and the boxers are cowardly brutes.
I should like to see her safely married.
But as yet, if I understand you, she's as pure as the driven snow. Charming.
Hers has been a cloistered childhood. Yet there is something romantic in her nature which causes me alarm. Supposing one of the boxes responded, he might not treat her politely.
I, on the other hand, would write her the most devoted letters and bow with old-world courtesy whenever we met. All I fear, to be perfectly candid, is that a certain confounded coldness, a defect in my nature, might be a cause of pain, dissatisfaction, or longing.
Well, my dear Paul, it is hardly a matter for me to speculate upon. I can only remind you that faint heart never won fair lady.
Very well, Henry. I will at least come with you and see your sister.
I'm afraid I cannot accompany you. You forget that I'm off to Europe next week. However, I'll give you a letter of introduction to the family.
All this being arranged, our good Paul took leave of his friend. And after walking about for a while with an air of distraction, he paid a visit to the apartment of another friend of his.
My dear Olga, I'm afraid I have some very ridiculous news for you. I am going to be poor no longer.
Tell me only one thing, Paul. Is she beautiful?
Not very, it seems. I've not seen her, but she's over 6'3" and disproportionately fat.
My poor Paul. She's simply bound to have hair on her face. What will become of you?
Besides all this, she's not very bright, I hear.
And now I come to think of it, what will become of me?
She has 40,000 a year, my dear Olga.
Paul, we women are given to incredible follies and we are jealous. I might refuse everything. I find myself capable of jealousy.
But on the other hand, are you or am I capable of living any longer without a little of that 40,000 a year?
Or some other.
But what other, my dear Olga? Where is another 40,000?
That is true, Paul. Am I right in believing that your gigantic bride-to-be is mentally 9 years, or is it 12 years old?
7, I should think, by all that Henry told me of her. She has an exuberant innocence. She writes to boxers, but caresses dolls.
Really? That is very interesting. Dolls are so featureless. Let me turn that off. That's better. Now, isn't there any great hurry, Paul? I still have that bracelet you found at Palm Beach. It would provide us with a few last weeks together.
Well, I was going to suggest, as a matter of fact, that it should be my present to the bride, for I like to do things in good style. However, something may turn up. I admit that I love you.
You shall promise me not to go near Boston for at least a month. I shall be busy. I have decided to wear my hair short, but at least we shall meet on the weekends. In between, you may say farewell to all your bachelor life.
Yes, that is true, Olga. I shall have to do that, I suppose.
Everything being agreed, this young couple spent the next month or so as Olga had suggested. And at the end of it, she saw him off to Boston, with a restraint that he found almost too admirable. He arrived at Boston, presented his letter of introduction, and was very well received by old Mrs. Van Omri. They got on admirably.
It is true, then, that you are still a bachelor?
I cannot bring myself to regard the modern girl as a true mate. Those clipped locks. That flat masculine figure. That hardness. That ultra-sophistication. Where are the curves, the innocence, the warm-heartedness of yesteryear? Why am I telling you all this?
You would have loved our dear Ethel. Such a big, healthy, affectionate, old-fashioned girl. You must meet her and her fiancé. Perhaps you could come to the wedding.
Nothing could be more delightful. Unfortunately, I have to return to New York almost immediately.
On his return, Paul called at once on Olga, but found that her apartment was locked up. She had left no address. He sought her everywhere. He saw in the papers an account of the wedding of Miss Van Omri to a Mr. Colfax. It appeared that the happy pair were on their way to the Ritz-Carlton, and so was Paul.
I'll just sit here in the lobby and console myself with a peep at the disadvantages attached to that $40,000 a year.
He sat in the lobby. Before very long, he saw the enormous form of what was evidently the happy bride crossing from the elevator.
Upon my word! There's a great deal to be said for the simple life after all. One at least preserves one's individuality.
He peered about for the husband. At last he saw a sensitive face in the neighborhood of the bride's hips.
That must be the husband. Very charming. Very charming indeed. But I've seen him before.
In order to make sure, he edged closer and was amazed to find that this husband was none other than his own Olga in male attire. He immediately applied for a private interview.
My dear Olga, this is a very pretty trick you've played on me, but what of your pride, Soi-disant? Think of it all.
You must regard the matter rationally, my dear Paul.
I'm so afraid there may be a scandal. You have no idea what spiteful tongues might make of it.
You underestimate the innocence of my wife. These dolls, as I suspected, were very ordinary dolls. And you must admit, Paul, that if either of us is to be in this position, I at least offer less grounds for jealousy. You had better be my secretary.
Paul submitted with a good grace, and for a long time enjoyed his occupation very tolerably. Fortunately, Henry Van Omri remained in Europe. On one occasion, there was a dinner party at the Colfax home, and a few of the male guests, with Paul, the friendly secretary, and dapper little Mr. Colfax, remained smoking together long after the gigantic bride had retired to bed. The conversation turned on women, a subject which the so-called Mr. Colfax enjoyed more than his secretary. They talked of attractions.
My wife is disarmingly simple. Why try to disguise it? Nevertheless, she has an amazing personality, buried, as it were, beneath her naivete. I am convinced it is there. I sense it. And yet, I could hardly find an example to describe. How do you account for that, Doctor?
Very simple, my dear Colfax. Your wife, if I may say so, also adorable simplicity. She does her admirable, robust physique to a little glandular maladjustment, which, always supposing you should desire what professionally we should regard as an improvement, could easily be put right. But who knows what she's like underneath?
It would certainly be interesting to find out.
She might be slim, vivacious, a positive butterfly.
It'd be like carbon ambergris out of a whale.
Or like uncovering a lower Paleolithic living floor in situ.
Or undressing an Eskimo girl at Christmas.
Tell me, pass me one more.
Might find more than you bargained for.
It's not too late.
Everyone was desperately keen on the experiment.
You must bring your wife to a little home that I have in Paris, where I have every facility for the treatment.
We shall come at once. You, Paul, better remain behind to deal with everything we shall have to leave unsettled.
Paul, therefore, was left. Ethel and her spouse and a good doctor boarded a plane for France and were not heard from for some 3 weeks. Then one day, Paul received a letter from Olga. She was still in Paris.
My dear Paul, you will be amazed at the result of our experiment, and possibly a little disconcerted, though you always were a connoisseur of poetic justice. Under the treatment, Ethel has lost no less than 100 pounds. The removal of this prodigious quantity of blubber has left her exposed as a lean, agile, witty, and very handsome man. How absurd that I should have been called Ethel so long, he observed to me when he was first apprised of this transformation. In order to put him at his ease, I replied at once, no more absurd than that I should have been called your husband. After all, the cat was, so to speak, out of the bag, and there was nothing else to do.
Far out.
Do you think it's too mean?
No. We must make the punishment fit the crime.
He took it extremely well. saying with a smile, "We must make the punishment fit the crime." On my part, I was not long in promising never to deceive him again. We are remaining on this side to avoid gossip, for the situation has a ludicrous side, which we might find painful. But not nearly so ludicrous or painful, my dear Paul, as it might have proved in all the circumstances had you had your original wish.
Isn't it just like the travel agent said? Have dinner in a left bank bistro, no telling who you'll meet. That was The Frog Prince by John Collier. If you stick around long enough, no telling who'll show up. Maybe even Dr. Strange.
Garçon? Garçon?
Oh, never mind. Call him Dr. Strange and speak his name in whispers. It's daytime in the city and unsuspecting men go about their work. The astral body of Dr. Strange, tired from travel and travail in distant lands, casts no shadow as it glides almost silently towards the master's retreat, there to rejoin his physical form.
It is good to be home again. Now I can rest, knowing that Mordo will not trouble me for a long time.
But no sooner does the man of mystery regain his mortal body than he finds himself in the grip of a powerful spell.
What? Only one man has the power to cast this spell, but why?
Suddenly, halfway around the world, Dr. Strange receives his answer.
Guruji,
say no more, my child. We are not alone. I have called you for a very special reason. Look to your left through the eye of the amulet and tell me what you see.
A spirit form? An ifrit? Does he dare to menace you, master?
No, no, my pupil. He is merely a messenger from the dread Dormammu.
Dormammu? The most powerful of the dwellers of the disputed dimension? What does he want of us?
Many years ago, that dimension was called disputed, but his name is no longer suitable. For Dormammu is its sole master. Were he content with that, you could rest, Stephen. But now he plans to enter the dimension of men. Yet I am too aged, too weary to stop him.
Say no more, my teacher. I shall confront him.
My child, were it not for his slaves such as this ifrit here, Dormammu might not even perceive your attack, though you hurled your most powerful spells.
Then please, master, dispatch him at once to announce me to Dormammu.
Ah, it is what I hoped you would say, my pupil.
Be gone then at once. You know our answer.
You will regret this day, both of you.
That spirit was itself once a lord in their world. Even as Dormammu's slave, he retains awesome powers. Their world is fraught with dangers. In the end, you will need more than I have taught you. For even I, at the height of my power, was unable to defeat Dormammu. Now, though surprise avails you not, Chela, you must depart at once. Take care you meet Dormammu neither before nor long after his messenger returns. It were best you fought him while his anger can help as well as crush you. May Rudra prepare you a way.
With incredible speed, the aged hands of the master form the complex mudras of a spell, and Dr. Strange is transported as swiftly as he was summoned. Quickly, the pulsating begins to cease, and a dreadful world takes form. The world of the Mindless Ones, the world of the dread Dormammu.
The journey was short. Would that I could find the ruler of this world as quickly. Perhaps with the amulet.
But as Doctor Strange sets out across the scorched gray wastes of the Dark Domain, he is watched by zealous eyes of Dormammu's messenger, who has lingered in returning to his lord.
So, it was wise to wait. It will be easy to defeat you. And though I have never battled a mortal before, it will give me great pleasure to slay you and earn me great favor with my master as well. Prepare to die!
Recognizing the messenger, Doctor Strange feels victory more than defeat and meets the attack with defense alone. And yet elsewhere in this world, other slaves have detected his arrival and have fulfilled their duty to Dormammu.
I saw him myself, and by his amulet I could see that he is not the Ancient One, sire, but the pupil.
What is this flesh? How can it so rise to mock me? Where is the Ancient One? Can mortality excuse him such an insult to my dignity? You have done well. It is his pupil. I can now sense his presence. Go there, subdue the Ifrit, and bring them both to me.
Yes, sire.
Is this eyeball? It will not do. I would be demeaned by such combat. There can be but one answer. The Ancient One knows I cannot be stopped in my own dimension. So he sends his disciple to draw me forth in haste. Then he can battle me on Earth while his rotting powers still exist. How can such dust be so presumptuous? I have beaten him before, and very soon we shall meet again with Earth as prize.
On the wasted plain outside, the battle between Doctor Strange and the Ifrit takes a sudden turn.
Not your doing, mortal, but the palace watch. Dormammu knows we are here.
Quiet! Dormammu knows more than you can find words to suggest. He sends for you. You too, sorcerer. Come with me or be dragged.
Eager to retain what strength he has left, the master of the mystic arts remains silent, and soon he and the Ifrit are brought into the presence of Dormammu.
Return at last, my swift messenger. And what is the news you bring?
The Ancient One, my lord!
The Ancient One refuses to face me, but sends his pupil instead. And do you think that I send you? That all this might transpire unbeknownst to me. I could have entered their world and scotched this vile mockery. But you...
Mercy, sire! I only sought to relieve you of the indignity of slaves!
Enough of your lies. You sought above all to gratify your whims. It were better you had sought to aid him. I cast you out to the land beyond the barrier. You are not worthy of the protection I grant my slaves.
No!
Should I call on him again, he will not linger. And now, mortal, speak up. Let us have your message.
I have no message, but speak for myself. You are forbidden to enter the dimension of men under penalty of
enough.
Death.
Enough. None may speak thus in the presence of Dormammu. Where is your master? Summon him at once.
You'll have to deal with me first. You wish to attack the Ancient One. It cannot be done while I am still alive.
You dare continue in this fashion? You are a bold fool. But you would do better to play the messenger. For then, you might save your worthless life.
That is not my first concern, but rather that I protect Earth.
Then, you shall live only long enough to see your world my captive. I shall hold you until then.
With incredible force, the spells of Dormammu leap forward at the magician, and the swirling fires in his eyes and mouth seem only to burn brighter with the effort. Shielding himself with the amulet, Doctor Strange attempts a counter.
I call upon the vapors of Valtor.
But the swirling mist never reaches its objective, and the master of the mystic arts is thrown back by the spells opposing him, and the center of his perception splits open wide and swallows him.
Consider this well as you lie in limbo, sorcerer. If you would save your world, you must first defeat Dormammu. But this cannot be done. If you agree to summon your master here, you may live on as you do now, my slave. If not, you will die when I have done with him and your world. Consider this well indeed.
Alone in an alien dimension, captive of the most powerful of the lords of black magic, Doctor Strange is about to fight the battle of his life, and the fate of the world is at stake. Be with us next time for the exciting conclusion of this episode of Doctor Strange, Master of the Mystic Arts. That's all for tonight, folks. Too bad we had to choose this week to leave Doctor Strange in a jam. I was kind of hoping we could get him to zap us back to New York City. The Radio was produced by Charles Potter, with technical effects by David Rapkin. In the cast tonight, you heard Richard Behrman, Neil Conan, Martin Gleitzman, Beth Latimer, Charles Potter, David Wilson, and yours truly, John Bassus. Thanks for letting us into your dining room. Good night.
The Radio was brought to you on tape, and it came from our archives, actually our 1971 archives, and it was brought to you over WBAI New York at 99.5 FM. It's 11:20 and we're running...
The Radio from 1971 in stereo from WBAI's archives. I'm running out of material from there. I think I may have only one show left from the archival material from WBAI. But hopefully we will get our hands on those other Doctor Strange shows. There may be some complete episodes of the Radio. We shall see. Okay, Gene Shepherd, we have two for you. The first one is just a 15-minute piece from Tuesday, this day in history, June 2nd, 1964. Apparently, the previous week, Shepard had done a program on Ayn Rand and the search for Superman. Well, he got a lot of angry mail, and he will rebut all of those comments. The show is only 15 minutes long due to California primary coverage, I guess, of what, the 1964 presidential election? We don't have time to hear that, though, so we'll just hear the 15-minute Gene Shepard portion of the show, June 2nd, 1964.
Is it all over? There we go. There, just like pulling a tooth. There we are. Came out screaming and yelling. You know, speaking of screaming and yelling, and as long as we're going to start the week off right, I must have hit a genuine sore nerve last week. A genuine exposed nerve on the program Read the Search for Superman. Oh, boy. I can always tell when somebody has tickled that raw, exposed thing that sticks out of every basically untapped tooth nerve. When the next day you come in and there's a pile of mail written in angry scrawls, you know, that kind of thing. Well, one of the most, I don't often talk about the mail, but one of the most intriguing things about this search for Superman thing is the outrage screams from the Ayn Randists, or the Ayn Randists, if you prefer, all of whom assume that I have not read Atlas Shrugged, or assume that I have not read any of the other badly written novels that have appeared, tracks, actually, that have appeared under her name. As a matter of fact, I can tell you, to the most of you, that my first argument over The Fountainhead occurred maybe 2 weeks after it was published, before most of you had ever heard of it, while you were still struggling through Raggedy Ann and Raggedy Andy. I hate to pull rank on you here. However, the argument always resolves itself, probably one of the most significant, I suppose you might say, outcroppings of this argument is that whenever you touch on the search for Superman in any given society, people will invariably get very excited, because this search is a very basic search. The search for a father, the search for an image that is all-seeing, all-encompassing, all-moral, and impregnable to the heirs, to the fleshly failings that we have. We're looking for a president, for example, made out of stainless steel that does not rust. We are looking for a president or a leader that comes from some very different plane of existence than we do. Why do you think most people were very angry at the fact that Harry Truman had operated a haberdashery shop unsuccessfully? That made him a very bad Superman. I mean, so that's going to be held against him for all time. No matter what he did from that day on, it doesn't matter. To many people, he remains an unsuccessful haberdasher. So we will increasingly find that our Superman will come from the ranks of people who have not had the opportunity to fail. In short, this is, to me, the basic reason why most of the men today who are making it big in politics are wealthy men, and wealthy by family rather than, in most cases, having earned the wealth. Because it's very difficult for a boy to fail whose father has $28 million in the bank from the word go. So it's easy to grow up to be a Superman under those conditions, but very difficult to grow up if you come from Hessville, Indiana, grow up to be a Superman, and you've worked in the steel mill. I'm sorry. You're never going to make it. Now, that's just a very side issue. But I think one of the most, to me personally, significant reactions to this discussion of the Superman, and for those of you who didn't hear it, it doesn't matter anyway. You all know that we're searching for it. Always have been, and man always will be. One of the most interesting reactions, and I'm talking psychologically, is that almost all of the people who lodged violent complaints about my, and said that what Miss Rand says, she says, use your brain. Use your brain. But yet, what was intriguing was that very few of the criticisms had any brain work in them. They were all violent, impassioned criticisms. Like, you slob, you got no right to talk about Miss Rand, you slob. She says, use your brain, you slob, slob. Die, you slob. Four unprintable epithets, and then there's a big splotch of ink, and that's it. Well, you see, the point is that almost everybody who is searching for Superman believes he is using his brain. And it depends on how you use your brain. Nobody seems to think, you know, when they talk about objectivism and using logic, that there is good logic and bad logic. There is logic that sets, and they're both logic. There is logic that sets out to prove a point, and then there is logic that is used to search for a point. I'm afraid that most people who are searching for Superman use logic to prove that Superman is possible, not the other way around. Now, that's just another side issue. However, I will say this, though, that that the search, you know, let's go back to Hitler's Germany again. You know what was intriguing to find that most of the philosophers, and I'm using great quotes around them, of the Nazi regime, and you know, most people only know Hitler. They don't know that there were dozens of Nazi philosophers who were very famous political commentary people and were called philosophers within the party, and in fact created the atmosphere that made Hitler only the spearhead. Most people don't know that here in America. For some reason or other, they only know that there was Hitler, and they figure that Hitler got up on a stump and got 9 million people following him, and that was the end of it. I'm sorry. That all of the philosophers, almost to a man, who were involved in this Hitler movement were rationalists. They claimed they were using their brain. They says, let's stop being sentimental about this stuff. Let's not be sentimental and romantic. Let's face it, some people are better than other people. And they went out to prove that there was a Superman, and strangely enough, it was them. Nobody ever proves there's a Superman, and it turns out to be somebody else. So I'm just saying to you, be careful when you use words like rationality. These words have always been catchphrases for people who want to prove, usually, an irrational point. The term rationality, the term objective, has about as much meaning as the term love. What makes you think that any man can be objective? We're all men. We all have our own failings. A short, fat man is not objective, no matter how hard he is about food, no matter how hard he tries. He is not going to be objective about fat either. he can claim he is. Well, I'm sorry. There's a lot of things that we cannot control. There are many things within us. And, of course, one of the great problems of the rationalist is that he will not concede that there are large areas of his physical being, that is the animal being that is within every one of us, that is every one of us, that there are large areas that have nothing whatsoever to do with rationality, have not, and are uncontrollable by rational thinking, that you cannot control your instincts. They are there. Now, you may be able to slightly curb them by rational thinking, by objective consideration, but you are not going to eradicate them, nor are you going to really essentially change them. Never. I'm sorry. There are several psychologists who are very unpopular in this country because, I'm talking about schools of psychologists, because their basic school is really, to make it into a very, very basic, broad definition, they say that there are elements within you that have more power and more potency than the feeble power of your mind, literally. And they say that if a man or if a person or if a motivational machine begins to cater to those parts and sides of that human being, that the mind will go out the window. Either that or the mind will be used to rationalize a basically irrational pursuit. In short, it would not be hard for me here, being a fairly good technician with words and ideas and so on, it would not be hard for me to convince a goodly portion of my listeners that they really are the victims of society. Wouldn't be hard for me to convince them of that. That not only are they victims of society, but society is an evil which is out to destroy them, basically a beautiful flower-like creature. Because it's something that all of us want to believe. Very few of us can ever get the guts or the irrationality to proclaim it. But it wouldn't be hard for me to do that. Really wouldn't, providing... I don't think it'd be hard for many people to do if they approach it in the right technical sense. Now, there are a lot of things involved in this search for Superman, and I'm not going to continue to do that show tonight. I will say this, though, that the more impassioned the cries, the more I recognize that a nerve has been struck. The more irrational... The boundless and groundless criticisms are made, the more I recognize that that this is a raw nerve. I find in my own mail, for example, I have found over the past 10 years a great change that's come in the mail, and it would be interesting to a good sociologist to look at a lot of this. For his own sociological research, that the change that has come is a growing implicit belief in a certain kind of superiority on the part of the letter writer. This is a new thing in our time. I've been around long enough, and I've gotten enough mail, and I've talked to enough people, and I've heard enough impassioned cries over telephones to have observed a change that most people, I suspect, would not be totally aware of. Because they live what you might call private lives, and their life is a private life, and they're involved with the lawnmower, and they read the newspapers, and these things are not reported in newspapers, because this is a day by day reporting of events, which have very little to do with day by day reporting of a zeitgeist. If we had a newspaper that reported not only the change in barometric pressure and the change in weather, but the change in atmosphere, the people's attitude towards the world and themselves, you'd have a fascinating newspaper. Speaking of zeitgeist, this is WOR AM and FM New York.
Honeymoon Hotel room service.
Hi, this is Robert Morrison, room 1112.
Hey, Mr. Morris, aren't you an MGM's hilarious honeymoon hotel?
Yes, I am.
Would you like me to send up some champagne?
No, ma'am, I've got...
Extra glasses?
No, I've got no...
Lucky to buy cigarettes, midnight snack?
I have everything but a girl!
Mr. Morris, you're breaking the rules of Honeymoon Hotel. You're a groom without a girl in your room.
But that's what I'm calling about. Will you marry me?
Oh. Mr. Morris.
See what happens when the bride stays home and the groom goes on a honey-chasing honeymoon.
Boy, it's exciting. Wow.
It's all Kisses and Honey with Robin Goulet, Nancy Pon, Robert Morris, and Jill St. John in...
Honeymoon.
Oh, jeez. Oh, boy.
Hotel in Metrocolor.
Don't miss MGM's new horror picture, Honeymoon Hotel, a showcase presentation starting tomorrow at specially selected theaters throughout greater New York, and it's getting greater all the time. Oh, yeah. Which, for some nutty reason, reminds me of your beautiful soul. Have you ever thought of expressing your beautiful crushed petal of a soul in Japanese haiku, the lovely 17-syllable, 3-line verse form? The wild geese having gone, the rice field before my house seems far away. Let's try an American haiku. My telephone not having rung, the spring can't be far away. My bills aren't paid. Yes, if you're a haiku man, send your entry into the Japan Airlines haiku contest. Earn yourself a Sony Micro TV, which is a fantastic television set, by the way. And have a lot of fun, and you can just express your soul all over the place. It has to be in by June 15th. Japan Airlines haiku contest, WOR, New York 8.
We are going to break away from the Gene Shepherd Show at this point to bring you on-the-scene reports from that hot California race involving Goldwater and Rockefeller, where the two men are running neck and neck in one of the warmest Republican presidential primaries in years. Let's go now to Los Angeles.
From June 2nd, 1964, Gene Shepherd on Ayn Rand. And we have a complete show for you now from June 2nd, 1970. Gene Shepherd talking about Dr. Pepper, Popeye, and the music of the Sicilian Jew's harp. Never before rebroadcast here on WBAI New York. Gene Shepherd, lost episode to wrap up our program tonight.
Just drifting along with the breeze. Just drifting along with the breeze.
Well, friends, welcome to the relevant hour. Welcome to the relevant time. Ring-a-ding-a-ding-ding-a-ding-ding. Ring-a-ding-a-ding. I'm getting all my equipment here ready here. Oh, for heaven's sakes. I must salute Italy. Fidenza Italy. Alfredo Giovanardi. 69 years old, won the title of King of the Noses in a contest to pick the longest nose in Italy. His 2.5-inch nose beat his nearest contestant by 1 millimeter. How's that? Only the Italians would think of having, you know, big nose contest. We must salute the Fidenza Italy. That's one contest I'd like to see judged. Then are measuring the guy's beak. I'm going to award you a brass figligee with bronze oak leaf palm if you can identify what the following tune is from. This is not a musical program, lady, so please don't get excited. What is the following tune from? What is that from? Yeah, that's right.
I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. I am what I am, because I am what I am. I am Popeye the Sailor Man.
You are just listening to Shepherd's famous solo that drove his mother completely off her rocker, and she has not yet recovered. I'm serious. It was at that point that she began to dislike me. And, I'm not kidding. For some reason or other, that thing stuck right in the top of my head. At that time, all these Popeye cartoons were very big. You go see, you know, the movies, and you see Popeye cartoons as well as the movies, the, you know, the strip. And that song used to come on.
I am Popeye the Sailor Man. I am what I am, because I am what I am. I am Popeye the Sailor Man.
Boop, boop. Remember, you go, boop, boop. And he's a little pipe that said, you know that I know some of the other lyrics? I'll bet you don't know these lyrics to that tune.
I am Popeye the Sailor Man. When spinach I eat, I cannot be beat. I am Popeye the Sailor Man.
You didn't know there was such a lyric. How about this one?
I am Popeye the Sailor Man. I am strong as the breezes which blows down the trees. I am Popeye the Sailor Man.
Boop, boop. Now, I'm sorry, you know, that is what is known as a mind that is just completely overrun with garbage. Now, everybody else knows, you know, great folk songs like the Wabash Cannonball. They all know Shenandoah Valley.
And it's very embarrassing to me. You know, I'm like this friend of mine is a very hip folk singing type, you know. And anytime, you know, he says, hey, anybody here know anything really groovy that we can all sing? How can you say, let's sing Popeye the Sailor Man? By the way, that's a true folk song, incidentally. I mean, because it's really, yeah, I even know, you want to hear some more lyrics? I am a Popeye the Sailor Man. I am strong at the spinach because I eat me spinach. I am Popeye the Sailor Man. These are all actual. You want to hear another one? There are hundreds of. Do you know that these are called the Songs of Popeye? It's an entire folio, and I have no access to it, but I know that there were over something like 300 verses that were called the Songs of Popeye, you know, like the Songs of Ahab, the Songs of the Wandering Minstrels, the Songs of Popeye. I am Popeye the Sailor Man. I am just a little fella, but I hasn't got any yella. I am Popeye the Sailor Man. That's right. That's one of the lyrics. Listen to this one. This is one of his more sad, introspective lyrics when Popeye would occasionally get a little romantic. I am Popeye the Sailor Man. Nevermore will I roam, for I feels right to home. I'm Popeye the Sailor. Popeye the Sailor Man. Boop, boop. I mean, you know, he was never going to roam again. But now these are all great tunes. Incidentally, since we're bringing up that type of trivia, Nick, what was the name? Now, I'm going to start you very simple so that, you know, I don't confuse you here. What was the name of Popeye's girlfriend? That is correct. Olive Oil. Now, next question. What was the name of her brother? No, Wimpy was not her brother. Who? That is correct. Castor Oil. That's right. I'm serious. Now, Castor and Olive had a cousin. And what was his name? It was not Oil. I'll give you a clue. He had the cousin. He only appeared briefly in the Ham Gravy. That is correct. Now, you see, we're having a little trivia. It's not really trivia because this is part of the basic American mythology and it's not trivia at all. Now, another question, Nick. Now, let's see. What was the name of the Popeye cartoon strip? It was not Popeye. It actually had a name that was very different from what most people called it. That is correct. Thimble Theater. And every sequence would start with a little curtain. I mean, they would go through a sequence that would take about 6 weeks, you see. In other words, one adventure. And it would start out with a little curtain that would say, next attraction, the adventure of the lost Jeep, or something like that, you know. And by the way, I'm going to have to ask you another one, since we're on that subject now. What was the name of, there was not really a name involved. There was a character in the strip that was totally evil, broodingly evil, brooding. What was this character called? What was the character called? A broodingly evil character. And I will give you a clue. The character was female. What? No. No. Broodingly evil. In fact, this character wore long, black, evil-looking rags. And I'll give you another clue. Now that you're beginning to think about it, I'll give you another clue. The character was always seen with a vulture sitting on its shoulder. Had a vulture. What a great character. You can't imagine this in a comic strip. The Sea Hag. That is correct. The Sea Hag. What a great concept. Now, I'll ask you someone. What was the name of the character that Popeye was continually fighting in the movie cartoons, this great big sailor with tremendous shoulders? What was his name? That is correct. Black Bart. He was evil. Oh, boy. Now, what was the name of the strange animal that appeared in the script? And, in fact, its name was later incorporated. You know, that cartoonist... since we're going a little bit on this subject, do you find this an interesting subject? What was the name of the cartoonist who created that fantastic script? Because I think that strip probably contributed more names to words. It contributed more words to our language than any other comic strip character. Actual words that nobody even thinks about anymore. They're just so part of our language, we don't even think about them. And I'll give you another clue. His name used to have at the bottom of the strip, he would have his name illustrated with a little tiny drawing. Seagar. Remember, it was a little cigar with the smoke coming up, and his name was Seagar. And I always remember one very important point, at least it was important to me as a kid, about Seagar, the guy that drew the Popeye strip. When I was a little kid, somewhere along the line, I read a story. It was in one of the magazines like Life or one of those magazines at the time, and it was a story about Seagar himself, you know, the guy. You rarely hear about cartoonists, you know, unless it's somebody, you know, very flamboyant who is kind of an exhibitionist guy like, yeah, say, Cap or somebody. But you rarely hear of people who create these great cartoon strips, which incidentally are very much part of our life. I mean, everybody, you know, everybody knows Popeye. Popeye probably, along with Mickey Mouse, were the two great characters that became worldwide. I mean, everybody in the world knew Popeye and still does. He's still with us today. You know, the word Popeye is a great character, along with Superman. These are fantastic characters, and you don't know much about the people who created them. The whole literature of comic strips, and Seagar, there was a story about Seagar, and I remember how fascinated I was about Seagar. Apparently, Seagar was a fanatical fisherman. And there was in the story, and of course, this attracted me immediately, because I, as a kid, I was, you know, nutty about fishing and reading about fishing and stuff, and he was a fanatical fisherman. So I don't know where he lived, but wherever it was, he built a house that was built right over a trout stream, right over it. I mean, over it, directly over it, and he could open his floor, and it had a trap door. You see, like a very well-decorated, it's an elegant trap door right in his living room. He could open his floor and fish for trout in his living room. Now, how do you like them apples? But that was Seagar. Now, I may be wrong, but this sticks in my mind, so I think it's right. All right, I'll ask you one more question about Popeye, if you're curious. I am. I mean, this strip always used to get me. What are some of the words that he added to the language? All right, goon. Do you know that the word goon, you hear the word labor goon? That word was taken from the Popeye strip. He had a character named Alice the Goon. And Alice was a tremendous, had tremendous strength, tremendous great face, and enormous, had curious fringe hanging at its arms. Yeah, it was an odd-looking character. It was Alice the Goon. And this was a character. Now, that was added right, speaking of, this is WOR, and we're in New York. And, all right, what were some of the other things he added to the language? How about Jeep? That is correct. The first published use of the word Jeep appeared when he created this little character. You remember the Jeep? It's a little animal. And what did the Jeep eat? In fact, there was a great deal of the script, the entire plot of Popeye at one point, hung on getting this character something to eat. This character only ate one thing. What did it eat? This little animal. It was a strange little animal that walked around on its hind legs. It looked like a combination dog, a curious little animal, spotted-like. What did it eat? Do you know, Lee? Orchids. It only ate orchids, so they had a terrible time. Now, what character was absolutely totally hung on hamburgers? That is correct. Wimpy. All right, now, who did he buy his hamburgers from? He was always in this joint buying these hamburgers or trying to buy them from this guy that ran this hamburger joint. And what was his name? And another question about it, the same character, when did he always promise to pay for his hamburgers? There was always one day that he promised to pay. That is correct. Say it again, Lee. Yes. He says, I will pay you Friday for a hamburger today. He always was saying, I will pay you Friday for a hamburger. And I always felt that Wimpy was based on W.C. Fields. And I always felt even further that W.C. Fields was based on Stan Lomax. So, you know, it goes round and round. Would you please hit the ding-dong for us, Nick? Yeah.
Dr. Pepper may be America's most misunderstood soft drink, but not for long.
That sounded good, didn't it, Nick? I'd love to play this little thing. Hey, you know, hey, if I may get off the subject here of old Popeye for a minute here, and I'm going to, do you remember the other night? How many of you remember the other night I played the Dr. Pepper thing, and I asked a question about it. I wonder what degree Dr. Pepper held. I said, how do you get to be Dr. Pepper? And, you know, a lot of people never heard of it. Well, some listener, now, I don't, this is no promotion, I will tell you, he lives out in Mineola. Some listener heard me say that, see? So he wrote to Dr. Pepper, which is in Dallas, Texas. And he asked him about, you know, Dr. Pepper. Who is this Dr. Pepper? You know, is there a Dr. Pepper? And you want to hear the story of Dr. Pepper? They sent back this thing, and he sent me the letter. Here it is. It says, Dr. Pepper has one of the most colorful backgrounds of any soft drink in the American market. Even its origin has a romantic setting. It begins with a young man who worked at a drugstore fountain in Virginia. The owner of the store, a doctor by the name of Pepper, had an attractive daughter who caught the eye of the young man, and soon the romance developed between the two. The doctor, having high aspirations for his daughter, fired the young man, discharged him, hoping it would remove him from the scene. It did, temporarily. Heeding the advice of Horace Greeley, who was a contemporary, who had said, go west, young man, go west. He traveled to Waco, Texas, where he landed a job at the Old Corner Drugstore. The romance was not, that's the name of it, the Old Corner Drugstore. The romance was not to be thwarted, however. Later, the young fountaineer returned to Virginia, where he reportedly was successful in his pursuit of the doctor's daughter. On his trip to Texas, he carried with him his penchant, it was his hobby, for mixing up junk in the fountain, you know. He loved to discover new flavors. One day, he hit upon one that really flipped his wig. Others hanging around the drugstore that afternoon expressed approval. And having learned of the romance in Virginia, these wise guys sitting there says, why don't we call this Dr. Pepper? That'll really get the old man sore. They did. They call it Dr. Pepper to get the old man mad. That's actually what happened. Well, a beverage chemist and a patron, some guy who used to come around there, whose name is R.S. Lazenby, he came into the old corner drugstore fountain, and he had a couple of glasses. He says, not bad. He says, why don't we put it in the bottle? So in 1885... after 2 years of testing, trying to put it in the bottle, blending and processing, they put it out, and it's exactly today the way it was in 1885. So if you want to know what they were drinking in 1885, it is Dr. Pepper. And incidentally, it is so perfect, in other words, it tasted so groovy, that they have not changed the formula ever since. And they had no idea. Now, all this stuff came from a listener. This is not promotional stuff. They had no idea that it was going to go, you see. These guys, it was just this little thing in the corner there in the drugstore. And so they started to sell it to other little drugstores in Texas. When all of a sudden, Saco, it hit. And it just became a national thing. For your information, by the way, and this is even more interesting, I mean, in some ways, I didn't know it. It says that since its origin in Waco, Texas in 1885, Dr. Pepper has gained distinction as being different from any other brand of soft drink. For one thing, it is not a cola. I always thought it was some kind, you know. It is not a cola. You want to know what it is? It is an exclusive and a secret blend of many flavors, which this guy mixed up one afternoon in 1883. And that's it.
Doesn't taste like anything. It doesn't taste like Coke, I can tell you. They're very different. And you know they have this 10, 2, and 4 thing? All right. A question that is frequently asked about Dr. Pepper is, what does this 10, 2, and 4 mean? Well, a Columbia University professor, Dr. Walter Eddy, conducting research into the human diet, discovered that 3 meals per day were insufficient to provide enough energy to keep an active person at top level. All day, efficiency, see? He pinpointed 3 times during the day when your energy drops to the lowest point. They are 10:30 in the morning, 2:30 in the afternoon, and 4:30 in the afternoon. So, that's the story. Now, all I can say is Dr. Pepper, he says, do you notice that they don't have a period after the doctor in the pepper? If you see the label, it just says doctor, but it doesn't have a period after that. I don't know the significance of that. But the old man really got mad, by the way. The original Dr. Pepper got bugged when they named it after him. I mean, you know, here you are, you're an official doctor, and all of a sudden they named this scoffing drink that the guys are hanging around the drugstore drinking. It's like, let's have a drink of Dr. Spock. What do you say, huh? I mean, you know, it doesn't. So, nevertheless, I'm just giving you all our, you know, tremendous information that are coming in from various listener types. And while you're mulling that piece of great, by the way, that's true Americana. As much as you put it out, it really is. I mean, here's a guy messing around in a drugstore. Speaking of Americana, what is more, absolutely, totally, to the end, what is more American than the majestic one-minute commercial? Please, let's hear another one. Oh, this is a groovy one. All right, here we go, friends. National Airlines is back, and if you think you're glad, boy, imagine how National feels. They're raring to get on a stick, ready to prove how much they've missed you. And here are 10 magnificent reasons to fly National. 1, Miami. 2, Fort Lauderdale. 3, Tampa. 4, Griffith, Indiana. 5, Saratoga. 6, Norfolk. 7, Orlando. 8, Daytona Beach. 9, Baltimore. 10, Rabbit Hash, Kentucky. 5, Charleston. National Airlines is back, all right, and they're all set. They're ready. They got the planes gassed up. All you got to do is get up the scratch and take off, friend. So sing it out. Happy, happy. Have a great flight. Whoa, whoa. Yeah, yeah. Whoa, whoa. National Airlines. You're going to have a great flight. Ask your travel agent to call National Airlines. Whew. I mean, gee, what a terrible way to earn a living. It says, announcer must sing abogado, ba ba wa wa woo woo. What the hell? How does Russ Dunbar do that one? Never heard him do it. I mean, does John do that too in the morning? Does? Oh, well. You can tell the pros, can't you? As you say, Nick, not much, but you can tell them. All right, let's see. We have another ding-dong in there. How about a trip to Chevron Island? Boop, boop, boop.
We need gas. I'll stop here.
By the way,
where?
National
Oh, I see the Polynesian restaurant. It's a Chevron Island service station. Fill it with Chevron Supreme. George says it keeps the carburetor clean, Gladys, and we get quicker starts, terrific power, and no engine knock. Eddie, look at all the South Seas decorations. I'll bet it is a Polynesian restaurant.
All done, ma'am. Anything else?
Why, yes. I'd like some Samoan chicken, the looky looky coconut.
I hate Hawaiian guitars.
A team of car experts voted Ford Torino, winner of the Car of the Year Award, over 15 worthy opponents. And do you know what? Right now, you can get the Car of the Year at a special sale price. The only thing you need to know about Torino to make you a big winner is the price it goes for right now. You see, your Ford dealer's economy drive is on. And there's a special sale price on a special edition of your Ford dealer's lowest-priced hardtop. If you buy now, you not only get the Car of the Year, but your Torino comes specially equipped with white sidewalls, wheel covers, dual racing mirrors, carpets, and final insert body molding that makes it look terrific. No, you don't have to be a car expert to be a big winner during your Ford dealer's economy drive. Just a guy who knows one heck of a buy when he sees one. Like the buy you get on Torino or on Maverick, America's biggest selling economy car. Come on, see your Ford dealer.
Now, listen, I have a lot of things to do here, and I don't want to be bothered by any of you types out there. Among other things I have to do, I have to remind you once again, you better get on the stick if you're going to order your year one poster. And believe me, they're great to have. In fact, one lady wrote and said her son got his year one poster and he hasn't been home since. It was the end of the ball game. Last seen in Tunisia. But if you don't know what the year one poster is, first of all, I'll tell you, you can't get it anywhere else. You're not going to get it in any of these poster shops. The only place you can get it is to order it, just the way I'll tell you to order it, and the only place you'll hear about it is right here. It is really a gas of a poster. I want to get you one of these, Nick. That'll really make your old man mad. Here, I'm going to get you one of these. Put it up, you know. Well, I'll try to figure that one out. This is a year one, and if you'll notice carefully, I'll pull a Mayor LaGuardia on you here. You see, I'm reading to the funnies here, to the kiddies. This majestic, multicolored, unbelievably complicated one, which is in the foreground, is the present world up to now. It has everything from pyramids to the subway chugging out of what looks like, I can't say it on the air. However, here it is. It's in about 4,000 different colors, and this is the future, you see. The attempt to fit now into the future is obviously not going to work. The future is blown to pieces, friend. And over here is what's left of the world, the country, you know. And over here is all I can say to you is you got to see it to see it, really. And I want to tell you this, the more you look at this, the more wild stuff you see. And it is a day glow poster in addition to being spectacularly lithographed. It's a great lithograph job, really is. Now, if you shine this thing under day glow, stuff will come out that will probably, if the wrong people see it, get you busted. So it's pretty wild. it's a great poster, it really is. And it says underneath it, heaven, earth, rock, Beatles, sound, time come together. And it's quite true, literally quite true. The size of the thing is about, I would say, close to 3 feet across. I would say about 32, 33 inches, roughly, across. And it's about 24 to 26 inches high. And it is a handsome bit of business for $2, believe me. And if you would like to order one of these, and I would recommend it highly, personally, send a $2 check or money order. Do not send cash. $2 check or money order to Year One. And for crying out loud, don't send it here. Send it to Year One, 460 West 34th Street, New York, New York, 10001. I repeat, Year One, 460 West 34. That's 34th Street, New York, New York, zip code 10000001. And the money will be returned if you are not totally flipped out of your noggin. They will send it back. So, okay, we've taken care of all that. Hey, speaking of taking care of things, I got one more little thing to mention here, and that is that I have a short story in the current Car and Driver. And I'm going to put that on you there, as well as a short piece. It's not too short, actually. In the current National Lampoon, in their Blight issue, it's their salute to Blight. So naturally, I have a piece in it. And that's true. They said, well, you were the first one we thought of. We're putting together a Blight issue. I'm sorry they missed me on the last one, though. It was the Greed issue. I think I'd have fitted better. Yes, my dear. Yes. Yeah, I missed the sexy cover issue. Well, that's been my problem ever since I first fell in love with Esther Jane Albury. I've been missing sex for years, but that's... I'm sorry, gang. That ain't exactly true. Well, all right, now, I'm going to do something here. No, I'm... This tonight, you know, it's a Tuesday night. There's times when you got to lay it on them. You know, you got to come right out and say it. And I have been unkindly treated by many listener types who are continually writing in and saying, well, if you play that damn Jew's harp again, I'm going to take that radio, and the rest I can't describe what they're going to do with it. But nevertheless, they get very furious. Now, I say that they get furious about this because Shepherd, you know, they're not used to the Jew's harp as a real official instrument, you see. They really aren't. You know, they think of it as a toy, and it makes a bad sound, they believe. Yes, they do. Now, I will not say this is true for young listeners. Strangely enough, kids are really ready to hear this stuff. I mean, they really, really buy the sound because they listen to it as a sound. Now, listen to me for a moment, Tom. Now, stop interrupting the crew there. Tonight, I'm going to do something that I have rarely ever done. I'm going to play for you a genuine Jew's harp solo. And you know that there's only one group of people in the world, that is certainly in the Western world, that play the Jew's harp regularly as part of their national instruments. I'm not kidding. Everybody thinks Shepard's kidding. No, I'm telling you the truth. And in fact, we have a recording, and it was sent to me by a listener. Now, I've heard this before, not this particular recording, but I've heard this before. Now you will see when you hear this where the derivation of my Jew's harp playing comes from. It is derived from this specific kind of Jew's harp. Now, there's two types of Jew's harp playing. There is the so-called Upper South Midwest Jew's harp, which is primarily a folk instrument, and incidentally is primarily an accompanying instrument. In other words, you'll hear some guy singing, you know, the Delmore Twins will be singing through their nose, and you hear them flapping adenoids and the whole bit going on, you know, and twang and Sears robot guitars, and way in the back you'll hear a Jew's harp plunking away. Well, this particular group of people, this national group of people, use the Jew's harp both as an accompanying instrument, but primarily a solo instrument, much in the same way that you've probably heard me play it. Now, I'm not attempting to instruct you tonight, but this is an imported recording, and as far as I know, it could conceivably be available here in New York City, but it is imported, a European recording, and I'll let you guess what country it is. I'll let you guess this. What country regularly plays a Jew's harp as part of their national instrumentation, their national music, all right? No, cut my... go. That surprises people because when they hear it, it's very difficult for them to determine the nationality of this because it sounds very Oriental. Now, I will play a solo myself in the same genre. This is a specific type of Jew's harp playing. Now, to begin with, I'll show you a little of his technique, why he got that sound. And it's a sound...
Oh,
is played in the Sicilian manner, in case you're curious. That is Sicilian. And the Sicilian name for the Jew's harp is the Maranzano. Maranzano. And the soloist on that particular side, you hear, was a man named Rienzi Pisciato, and is a famous Maranzano player in Sicily. This was recorded in Sicily. Do you want to hear some more Sicilian music, though, the real? Now, they have another instrument. It's a flute, which they play, which is like a reed, and it is made out of a reed. And it is thousands of years old. The thing is played from the end and is blown into. It's not blown over, it's blown into. And it's probably one of the oldest wind instruments, certainly one of the oldest. And it's you've probably seen pictures of Pan. Well, this is a Sicilian instrument, actually. And they play this instrument with the Maranzano. They also play it with a particular Sicilian type of guitar. And these are three of the basic Sicilian instruments, genuine Sicilian music. Nick, will you give me, if you want to hear a strange, odd, keening sound, would you give me, on the other side, Canto Profondo, which is, you just don't think of this as Italian music. You just don't, because most people, when they think of Italian music, they hear panicule, panicule, ta-ta-ta, la-ta-ta-ta. Or they think of some guy singing a Neapolitan love song, and you know, this kind of thing. Here is a keening chant, and one of the most sad, lonesome. By the way, Sicily, I've only been in Sicily once, is one of the most haunting, sad, strange, lost and gone, out of this world places. It is absolutely in another world. And they are in another world, culture and everything, from the rest of the Italians. And this is a canto profondo, or a deep, sad song. If you heard this offhand, you'd probably think it was Moroccan or Algerian. Now, all right, now, Nick, now take that off. Now, I want you to flip it over, and I want you to play cut one on the other side. And this is the most famous. This is the one part of the Sicilian music that has gotten worldwide, following. This is a... And then, man, you hear these things and they really go. Would you play me cut one? Is cut one on that side? Tarantella? Correctimo. All right, hit it. Here, listen to that. Hear that Jew's harp? Hear? Boy, listen to these guys going now. Do you mind if I sit in with them? There they go. Sicilian tarantella. And they dance like they're out of their minds when they hear these things. Here's that flute. That's great. Basic, you'll hear them. The basic instruments of Sicily are the mandolin, the guitar, and this flute, which is the fischeletto, and of course the maranzano, which is the Jew's harp. And naturally the tambourine here. This was recorded in Sicily, by the way. And recorded in the open air, if you're curious. Not a studio recording. Listen to him play that flute. Tarantella, Sicilia. This is probably, incidentally, Sicily happens to be also one of the most beautiful places in the world. But strange, it's spooky. This is Tarantella. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, you know, this... Now, you notice he gets the sound on the juice harp. It's a rough, rasping sound. It's done this way. You see, as opposed to... This is the more conventional. This is the Italian, European, Sicilian way. You see, you get that sound of intake of breath and intonation, and it's a difficult instrument to really master. And, yeah, but that, thank you. Here's our own tarantella here. I hear it. There it comes. But sitting here, I was hit by Popeye, the sailor man, this afternoon, and mulling things over. I thought, you know, it's interesting to, when you're dealing with music, now I don't often do a show about music, you know, Nick, rarely, but I find so much that involves music. I think the whole world of music is just so broad that there's hardly any end to it. But I think that of all the things that man does, music probably develops more prejudices than any other single thing. Curiously enough. Because it's very basic, very emotional. And you know that nobody has ever discovered why man, I'm using man in a cap sense here, likes music. Nobody's ever discovered that. We're the only creature that thinks of sounds, and I mean even mechanically contrived sounds, as pleasant. It's an odd thing. I mean, why somebody scraping some strings over a piece of stretched cat gut is pleasant to us, nobody knows. It's just a... Well, I suppose a cat doesn't know why it likes catnip either, as far as that goes. But we are a strange creature. But the juice harp is probably one of the most basic and, I should say, strangely emotional instruments this side of the viola. I say it and I lay it out just for what you can think of. There it is. You cannot play chopsticks on a juice harp, friend.
Yes, another never-before-rebroadcast episode of Gene Shepherd from June 2nd, this very day in history, 1970. And that's it for the dustbin of history. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. Thanks for tuning in. If you would like to visit us on Facebook, we have a page called the Dustbin of History. You can even get into it if you ask politely. And you don't look too flaky. You're not one of those kids from South Africa always trying to get in. Maybe they like radio drama from America in the 1960s and 70s. Who knows? At any rate, the Dustbin of History on Facebook. Find out all about it before it happens. We're going to get this show on the air by 1 o'clock? Well, if we do it in two parts, I guess we can. Coming up next, Emerson Unger with K-Wave USA. So you stay tuned to WBAI New York. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week. So long, gang.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells...